I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. An article in Vanity Fair caught our attention, and it's about what's happened with the Washington Post and the New York Times, the papers that people are going to in huge numbers to get information on what's going on in the Donald Trump administration. James Warren writes, he's the author of the piece, Donald Trump himself, who's called the press the enemy of the American people, has proved to be a primary catalyst for explosive hikes in the Washington Post readership, including 1 billion page views a month. That's a lot. And Trump has been very good for the failing New York Times, though its single most influential story may have been the disclosure in 2015 that his Secretary of State Hillary Clinton exclusively used a personal email account to conduct government business. We hope to have him with us in just one moment. He he's from New York originally. He is former managing editor and Washington bureau chief of the Chicago Tribune, and he is also former Washington bureau chief of the New York Daily News. He's written for The Atlantic, Huffington Post, Vanity Fair, Daily P, Beast, CNN. He's been on MSNBC and also on Fox News. We're doing a two-part hour today. The second part of the program, this was a young man whose words were very important, and we've asked him to join us again as I'm down to my last couple days broadcasting. Mukhib Dyer will join us. He is the founder of the I Will Not Die Young campaign, and he works mentoring young African-American men in the city of Milwaukee. He lost his godson to gun violence on 28th and Burleigh some years ago, and it really made him decide to do this work full-time. He's a poet. He's an award-winning poet, and so he will be with us to talk about violence in the central city and guns and what we can do to have a complete change in these kinds of deaths, which would be welcome. Let me tell you about tomorrow as we're trying to find James Warren. I'm not sure where he is. So tomorrow during our program, we are going to, my family is heavily immersed in baseball, and I like baseball, and I don't think we've ever had a chance to speak with Commissioner Emeritus Bud Selig. He will be with us tomorrow. He has just been inducted, and it happened on his birthday, no less, to the Baseball Hall of Fame. He, of course, brought baseball back to the city of Milwaukee after many, many years of trying to get it here. Milwaukee owes him a debt of gratitude for that, and he's done some remarkable things when it comes to diversity in baseball and trying to level the economic playing field in baseball. We'll talk to Bud about that. And then Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker, who never fails to entertain us with his many, many stories. And the thing that amazes me is that he's done this for so many years. He has all these stories to tell, and they're always interesting. And to be able to talk like that is a true gift. He's entertained people in Milwaukee for a long, long time. He will be with us. David Axelrod will also be joining us. I think he's a really fine political analyst. He is doing a lot of political analysis work now on a podcast, and he's done some television specials on CNN and other places, and I've wanted to interview him for a long time, so it's amazing when you're about to retire. Or he's only going to be on the air for a couple more days. Oh, okay, I'll do it. No, he was doing this willingly. He's a very gracious man, and he'll have a lot to say about politics. And then Thursday will be my last day here, and we're going to listen to some interviews. This is the kind of job where you do it and the show is done and you're thinking about the next show, so you never have very much time to reflect. So I've had the chance over the last week or so to listen to parts of interviews with people like Studs Terkel, Maya Angelou, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Senator John McCain, Senator George McGovern, who told a great story about campaigning with John Fitzgerald Kennedy for the 1960 presidential election, Senator Bob Dole, Ken Burns, and we're also going to talk with some former longtime producers of this program, Rhonda Fanning, who will pick a couple of her favorite programs, K.P. Whaley, and also Scotty Myers. So those people will all join us, and they'll pick some of their favorites, and I understand there's some kind of a blooper tape as well, which we will listen to some of that. So all of that is coming up. And then we'll take a few. I don't want to take a whole lot of listener calls because then I'll just cry. And I don't want to cry the last day Well, I'd be kind of happy because we're going to have chocolate cake at the end of the show. So how can you not be happy about chocolate cake? So that's the lineup for Thursday, and we're still trying to find our guests. So, you know, in the meantime, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to open the phone lines to you because I'm not sure if we'll get Mr. Warren or not. But I'm interested, you know, in a couple things. One is, what is your source of news right now? Are you avid readers of the Washington Post and the New York Times? Is that how you're keeping up the importance of newspapers that are important to the American dialogue? Where do you go for important information? One of our guests last hour said it's up to us. We're not reading as much as we should. When you're looking at places to go with solid information, where do you go? So let's take phone calls. And our number is 800-486-8655. Oh, here he is. I think we got him. 800-486-8655. We are also asking you that question during our conversation with Mr. Warren. Where are you going to get information? And so that will be the subject and the focal point for our phone calls as well. But it is amazing to see what's happened. And now there's this competition between the Washington Post and the New York Times. Who breaks the story first? The New York Times, more resources and more people. But the Post is a pretty scrappy place, and they've put a lot more resources into this as well. And I believe we have James Warren with us now. Are you there, James?
Hey, guys. Hi, how are you? Sorry, I'm unexpectedly shepherding our eight-year-old today, and my schedule is a little off whack.
Where are you going with your eight-year-old, Jim?
I am at a golf driving range on Lake Michigan.
Are you really? Well, that's a pretty good place to be. It's a pretty day, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, it's far from the maddening fray of various newsrooms like the New York Times and Washington Post.
Exactly. Well, we're going to have to move into that and talk about that for a moment. I was amazed in the lengthy and very interesting article you wrote in Vanity Fair to find out how these newsrooms are really humming. And boy, do they have increased readership and people who are looking online. Lots of hits, huh?
Yeah, it's dramatic increase. I mean, I only wish for the sake of a lot of local newspapers around the country, whether Wisconsin, Illinois, Nevada, Maine, wherever, that it was similar, but it really isn't. But they've had dramatic increase. In the case of, say, the New York Times, they even have a total of two million paid digital subscribers.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty remarkable. And, you know, they're getting both of them are getting something like, you know, a billion or more unique page. I mean, it's the crazy, crazy numbers. And at the root of it is, you know, a mix of old-fashioned reporting values. And somewhere in the mix, this incredible story of Donald Trump.
Yes. The Washington Bureau chief for The Times, you quote in the story, you had an interview with her. She said there's a relentlessness to this that's new, the need to match competitors quickly. So you've got breaking news, cable TV all the time, the behavior of the president himself, the tweets she calls provocative and outrageous, the attacks on the press, the cornucopia of outright falsehoods. I mean, it makes me exhausted just to read that list. This is tiring.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit of a personal comparison. During the Clinton era, was in Washington, D.C., running the Bureau for the Chicago
Tribune. Yes, I know.
But you know, that was an age in which, say, if you know, you were a source of mine who would say, you know, 2:30 in the afternoon Central Time had whispered some great story into my ear, you know, I probably still had 3-4 hours before my next deadline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, I mean, you may be, you know, calling your editor and then instantly tweeting out the sum and substance of the story within 5 minutes. And, you know, these folks are competing with one another, and it's not just on political stories. It's also on folks like Reuters and Bloomberg when it comes to financial stories. You know, they are measuring victory and defeat by, you know, whether they beat someone maybe by 5 seconds. On a tweet, even before they may, in some cases, write the actual story. So it is night and day, and as much stress as I felt as a Washington bureau chief, it doesn't come close to what these folks are facing. And with a guy who's as unpredictable as Trump is, I mean, a guy who, yes, you better check his his tweets or see if he did tweet at 6 in the morning Eastern time, happen. And I mean, it is interesting because for my primary job with the Poynter Institute, I tend to get up real early in Chicago, a little before 5, and then watch a little bit of the cable morning news shows. And there are no shortage of times when one can be watching one of these shows, and then 10, 15 minutes later, the President of the United States, clearly watching the same thing and usually pissed off, has tweeted something. Usually nasty.
Mm-hmm.
That means if you're the bureau chief, like she is at the Times, you've got to have folks analyze, looking at that stuff immediately, perhaps writing a quick story. So, the traditional, 9 to 6 or 9 to 7 day becomes more like a, 15, 16, 17 hour day for a lot of these people.
Yeah. Does it all make you want to take your son to practice golfing more often?
Yeah. I'm not necessarily... As a journalist at heart, I'm envious of not being in the middle of a great, great story. I mean, one of the great political stories of our time. But I also do think there's, friction between technology and, journalistic precision and the ability to be contemplative.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's very tough. And even folks at the Times and the Post will admit, the pressure's there, that, something that maybe in the best of all worlds you'd want to spend another couple of hours mulling, well, for competitive reasons, you may not be able to.
Mm-hmm. Don't you find it ironic, you write in the piece in Vanity Fair, that Trump himself, who has called the press the enemy of the American people, has proved to be a primary catalyst for explosive hikes in the readership?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an even greater irony, and you might call it hypocrisy, in the same guy who bashes us absolutely is desperate for our legitimacy and our support. I mean, the same guy who continually rails about the quote failing quote New York Times and the propagators of fake news like the Times and the Post, I mean, he's regularly in touch, particularly with the Times. He so wants to win them over. He so wants to be liked by them. So, yeah, you've got the guy who's, got the big ego and, may have a little touch of, narcissism to him, just wants to be loved by these big elite journalism establishments, regardless of the political strategy at play of bashing those same people.
You also outline what happened in newspapers, and both those papers, the Post and the Times, not very long ago when the recession hit. The people were really worried in both those papers, weren't they? And now they're hiring people, but holy cow, it was bad.
Yeah, but it's no different than the situation you faced and to a certain extent still face in in Madison or Milwaukee or certainly Chicago. Where your whole business model has been upended, your circulation by some metrics, paid circulation has dropped maybe 50% in a very short period of time. And the digital increase you have in readership, it simply doesn't in any way, shape, or form make up for the lost revenue
mm-hmm.
on the print side, all the more so with, roughly 80% of advertising, be it local or national, now going to Google and Facebook. So, that's the car dealership in Madison or, another tried and true advertiser in Milwaukee who 10, 15, 20 years ago, routinely went to the newspaper. Maybe he went to TV, maybe some stuff in radio. Now there's been a dramatic turn with about 80% of that going to Google and Facebook. And it is a killer and not something that the Post or the Times have any magic antidote to. And remember, for those who don't know the insides of the ownership realities of these businesses. They're two very different situations at the Post and the Times. The Post now is essentially owned by Jeff Bezos, the second richest man in the world who runs Amazon.
Oh,
and
goodness.
The Times is owned. Times is run by a family which is in its fifth generation, and the key folks who are now taking over are in their 30s. They have no other revenue stream. The paper is all they've got. I mean, Jeff Bezos has all of us, you know, what, 70, 85 million or so Amazon Prime subscribers alone, just Amazon Prime, you know, giving them $100 a year.
Goodness.
And, you know, making, you know, huge sums of money. The and though the Post is set up as a private, separate entity, the fact is Bezos has given them a whole lot of money. The Times is a very different situation, and which is why I think ultimately you have to laud the Sulzberger family for sticking with it, but wonder still how long they can go without ultimately some big infusion, because they're on the revenue side, if you can believe it, they are way, way, way down. I mean, way, way down, like maybe $1 billion
in revenue
from where they were 10 or 12 years ago, despite this amazing increase in readership today.
And you asked the question, I wonder how you answer this. You can argue, you say that Trump has brought both newspapers some time, but it makes you wonder if their success will continue once he's no longer an irresistible and unsettling object of scrutiny.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, at some point, the so-called Trump bump, it's going to change. I mean, I think, disagree with me if you like, but I mean, whatever it is in life, I mean, one can get finally kind of bored by something.
Right.
You know, it might be your favorite TV show, and then, you know, your favorite late-night comic.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you realize you're not as focused on it or him or her as much as you used to be. And I think that could happen. And, you know, I've wondered, as I'm sure some of your listeners have, at what point does the Trump base, some of it in Wisconsin, you know, perhaps turn against him? There's no real evidence right now that it has, but you know, if you're a journalist like me, you say, well, look at all these you know, these falsehoods and outright deceits and misconceptions that he's propagating. You know, this is outrageous, but it has not necessarily had a lot of impact on his base, which seems to see it all as sort of part of his, you know, his appealing bravado. And at the same time, you cannot forget that his continually attacking us in the press has had impact. I think it has definitely had negative impact. And, you know, it's continually, you know, harping about fake news and bashing newspapers and essentially delegitimizing, attempting to delegitimize us and essentially devaluing the basic notions of fairness and standard. It's having some impact.
Right. Well, I can tell you exactly what I'm going to do, because I can say pretty much what I think at this moment, because I'm retiring the day after tomorrow, and I'm going to read more books about Abraham Lincoln, James.
Well, be my guest. There's actually there's a somewhat controversial Hillary Clinton supporter, former Bill Clinton aide, Sidney Blumenthal, who has volume two of a very, very good.
Is it good?
Lincoln,
I haven't read that
Lincoln
yet.
Biography. Yeah, I read the first one. It is very good. It's about Lincoln's early years, and I would, you know, I would definitely recommend it. But if you're serious about studying Lincoln, I hope you have another 60, 70 years left
I know.
On Earth, because, my gosh, there's enough written about the guy.
How true, and he's so worth knowing about. Let's go to a few phone calls for you. James Warren is our guest, and we're talking about what's happened at the Post and the Times as a result of the Donald Trump presidency, and we're looking beyond that, too. I'm asking the question, where do you, the audience, go to get really in-depth, important information? What do you consume? What about the future of newspapers, now, even though they're seeing an explosion because people are working very hard with stories coming so rapidly that reporters have to be on it from early in the morning until very late at night because the stories are changing and the tweets are changing. Where do you go to find out about this? Do you find this a thrilling time for getting information online in newspapers? We are talking with James Warren, who has a fascinating article in Vanity Fair. Our number is 800-486-8655. And let's go to Betsy, our first caller in Middleton. Hi, Betsy.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. It's sure. Nice to talk to you, and congratulations on your retirement.
Thanks, Patsy.
I read both the Milwaukee Journal, Milwaukee Sentinel Now, and the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN. I do read Vanity Fair. I mostly read the political articles in Vanity Fair. And I grew up in a family where we read multiple newspapers every day. My dad read the Chicago Tribune, both the Journal and the Sentinel, the local newspapers, sometimes the Fox River Valley newspapers. And it was just part of our growing up that we always read a lot so we could compare what we read and arrive at our own conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder for people to do that now because there's so much coming at them.
James.
Yeah, I mean, you have this, as I said, this dramatic decrease in print circulation of American newspapers and this daunting problem, notably on the local level, of trying to figure out what's a new business model for papers so they can sustain the sort of healthy, large newsrooms that enable them to cover the community. And I think, you know, a big related question will be, will a younger generation be willing to pay for digital news products? Will they be willing to pay an amount of money that will allow you to have, you know, 40 reporters in the newsroom rather than 15, that will allow you to cover state agencies like you may have covered them 20 years ago, that will allow you to do the sort of lengthy, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 month long enterprise reporting that for too many smaller papers now can just be a luxury they can't afford? I mean, I'd love to know, will my kids be willing to spend $100, $150 for a news product? I just don't know.
Well, they have to because you're their dad.
Well, I mean, I force feed them paper in the morning, and, you know, maybe it'll have some impact. But the realities are the, you know, circulation data, which is right now not promising.
Right. What was the figure? Where did I have rolling around in my head 1,300 people in the newsroom at the New York Times at 1 year? Is that right?
Yeah, no, right now it's a you know, pretty liberal definition, but there are 1,300 people who, you know, include big time journalists and can include, you know, support staff. But it is a remarkably large group of folks, yeah. And one thinks of the Post, the New York Times and the Post in tandem, as I do in this piece. So the reality is that the Times, as those many folks will admit who see them both, I mean, they have a lot more resources to cover a lot more things. Post
yes.
is around 750 editorial people. In both cases, that dwarfs what your average paper was. When I left the Chicago Tribune in 2008, as managing editor, we had maybe 650 folks in editorial, which was a nice, healthy number. I don't know what it is now, but it's surely like under 400, maybe 350. That just means that you can't cover the same amount of things. And, you know, whatever neck of the woods you know, want to cover, whether it's politics or local business, you know, stuff happens when they're not journalists poking their nose into things
right.
occasionally.
Yeah. Let's go to Jay next in Menominee. Hi, Jay.
Yes, good afternoon, Kathleen, and good afternoon, sir. This is a topic I look into, and I just would like to comment on
sure.
who's really behind the news. There are influences. And there is such a thing as a shill, whether it's coming from, you know, the government or a certain movement that will influence social media. And as far as the ownership of media in this country, it is definitely consolidated. And there is a narrative that is pushed.
All right. Well, let's talk about ownership. You mentioned it a little bit. Bezos and the family owning the New York Times.
Burger, yeah.
What about the ownership of both papers? Do they have, I don't know, special interests?
Well, I mean, I think you could argue that more owners than not have, in some ways, special interests. You might have made your fortune in a particular industry. You might be you know, somewhat partial to them. You might have personally a particular political ideology, but the question is, are you going to impact the actual news coverage of the, you know, the say the newspaper or TV station or radio station you own? That's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, I can't hear you, James. I can't hear you very well. Is there something weird with your phone? There we go.
It's, you know, I mean, all people who own operations have, you know, particular political views. But the question is, do you impose them on the folks who are reporting for your newspaper or radio station or TV station? That's where the rubber meets the road. And obviously, you know, there's a rich tradition, not necessarily laudable in this country. And it doesn't, you know, it's only about, you know, 70, 80 years ago where, you know, papers were highly politicized. And you might have, you know, 5 or 10 papers in a big city. And, you know, you knew instantly what their, you know, point of view was. It's only really, you know, relatively recently and sort of, you know, starting in the 50s and 60s of the last century that you began to have, you know, a change in a fair amount of journalism and, you know, the rise of, you know, notion, real rockbed notions of fairness and moderation. But, you know, go back in a time capsule, whether it's, you know, Milwaukee or Chicago or Los Angeles, you know, 80, 90 years ago, and the things were, you know, highly, highly political. So I think, you know, your mainstream newspapers are, in that way, I think, far more responsible than, you know, their predecessors a long time ago.
Right. One more phone call. Steve in Tomahawk. Hi.
Yeah, I think that more people are going to continue to get their news from radio because the television networks have kind of destroyed their credibility by reporting their opinion as if it is a fact.
Well, I'm glad you're a radio lover. Jim, of course, radio will be there, right?
For sure, but, you know, one you know, element of American media that is often forgotten, particularly by sort of elite press critics who tend to write a lot about, you know, the national cable news channels or the primary papers, is that most Americans still get most of their news from local television.
Right.
And that's forgotten about. I mean,
right.
I did a story which got a fair amount of feedback about, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks ago, where I just took the ratings in Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles of all the news-related morning shows. And in every market, you saw the same thing, that news show, and now those things, you know, now can be 2-3 hours long. And they, in some markets, they may start at 4:30, 5 a.m. in the morning. But in all the major markets, those local news shows totally outpace the famous, you know, the famous cable news network, CNN, MSNBC.
Yes.
So, for instance, WGN in Chicago, they have a morning news show, the WGN Morning News, that has 7 or 8 times as many viewers as, say, Morning Joe on MSNBC. It has more viewers than CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News combined, you know, between, you know, say, 6 and, you know, 5 and 8 a.m., and that's where people tend to get their news. And though we look at things when we cover media and cover Trump, we're inevitably talking about a left versus right political split in the media. I think another way to also look at it is national versus local.
Yeah, those are interesting statistics. Jim, thank you very much. It was a fascinating piece. Thanks so much, and I will follow you in retirement.
My pleasure, and good luck with all that Lincoln stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, I've been at it for a long time, and it'll continue for the rest of my life. James Warren, he's a chief media writer for Pointer, former managing editor and Washington bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune, and also for the New York Daily News. And you have seen him frequently on CNN, MSNBC, and also on Fox News. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Well, we've been listening to a lot of old shows, and I've been talking with producers who've been here for many years. Scotty Myers did some wonderful production work, and this is a person who was a favorite of his, a very important conversation, and voices that we don't hear as often as we should. And so I'm delighted that Muhib Dyer could be with us again during these final days of my being on the air. He has started the I Will Not Die Young campaign to help millions of at-risk youth to secure their right to have a life, to have a long life, to have a great life, instead of succumbing to the belief that they are worthless. He has performed all over the country. Muhib has. He is a poet. He was a finalist at the National Poetry Slam, the nation's top spoken word competition, co-founder of Flood the Hood with Dreams. He has brought the art of the spoken word to inner city young people and has encouraged people to take responsibility for their futures. He is from Milwaukee. His godson was a 16-year-old who was killed in Milwaukee in 2005. And he has spoken movingly on the air about that and about the work that he's doing, and we're delighted to have him here. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Ms. Yeah. Dunn. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you. You moved a lot of people, and what you have to say is so important. You are a poet, really, but you've brought that, and that poetry... Yeah. Can be so incredibly strong and important, can it?
Yes, ma'am.
The chance you do, the poetry that you get from other people who are experiencing violence and not feeling much of who they are and who they can be, poetry can reach people.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I started poetry a long time ago when I was in college now. And like other poets, I started off when I was young and, you know, I was ambitious. I wanted to win the poetry slams and I wanted the accolades and I wanted to be a star.
Sure. But why not?
But somewhere along the line, I was blessed to surround myself with wise men and wise women. One of my poetry mentors, his name was Mumba. He just died a few weeks back. Oh. And Mumba would always tell me that it's okay to have the accolades, but who are you going to help? And that, as well as being blessed enough to have a mother who was a servant, those two people in my life in terms of my poetry journey kind of put me on this path of using my words, not just wanting to be a poet for poetry's sake, but using my words as a vehicle to be able to reach the masses of people and to make a difference in the lives of young people today.
Mm-hmm. I Will Not Die Young campaign. Tell me about how that started.
Well, the I Will Not Die Young campaign followed another movement that we created in Milwaukee called Flood the Hood with Dreams. And Flood the Hood with Dreams was born out of classes and workshops that we began to do at the Milwaukee public school system, where we would go into the classrooms and ask young people the questions of what you want to be when you grow up, a question that all of us was asked sometime in our lives. And they would raise their hand and they would say, "Ooh, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a businessman, a businesswoman. I want to own a Fortune 500 company. I want to rule the world." They would give us politically correct answers. And then there would be one young kid who was sitting in the back of the classroom, not paying attention, throwing spitballs. Mm-hmm. And I would ask the young man, "What you want to be when you grow up?" And he'll wave me off. And I say, "What do you really want to be when you grow up?" And he'll look me dead in the eye, like I'm looking you in the eye right now. And he'll say, "Excuse my language, don't come around here talking about a dream. Because where I come from, we don't make it past the age of 21. And where I come from, I was walking down the street in my neighborhood and I saw my friend get shot in the head. And the hood told me I better not tell. And where we come from, we haven't seen our fathers one day in our lives. And where I come from, my little sister got molested by my auntie's boyfriend and she didn't tell anybody. Why? Because they said she was too fast and she deserved it anyway." So we started calling our organization Flood the Hood with Dreams because we believe that the children of Burleigh, Garfield, Galena, Vine, Center, Houghton, and Buffum in zip codes like 53206, that they say is the most incarcerated zip code in this country, they deserve to have a dream too.
I know that you've done things where you've had people raise their hands. How many of you plan to live to be the age of 21?
Yes, ma'am.
And how few hands go up?
Yes, ma'am. Well, it's they say repetition is the mother of learning. So if you're a young person and you grow up in inner city Milwaukee and you walk by the shrines, the teddy bears, and the flowers constantly.
Right.
And you know, as opposed to playing soccer or a little league, you know, it's an occurrence in your neighborhood to hear gunshots at night, then you quickly come to the conclusion that I might not be around long. I might not live long. So I think it is up to us to really begin to try to do everything that we can to change that dynamic in the minds of a child.
So what are you doing? What do we do? Why are there so many gun deaths? What do you do? It's a huge issue. You got to give people a chance to have a full life.
You do.
How do you do it?
Ah, I wish I had a magic wand.
Well, you do more than most people. I wish
I could wave a magic wand and it all goes away. But I know it must begin and because I can't do it by myself, and none of the activists and the grassroots people can, and it's a lot of them in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that's trying very hard to tackle this problem and this issue and make some changes, but we can't do it by ourselves. It has to almost be a nationwide shift in the consciousness of how we relate to young people. The great Mother Teresa once said that the greatest disease in society or in mankind is not, it was of course tuberculosis of her day, but AIDS of our day. It's not the greatest disease. The greatest disease is the feeling of unwantedness, a lack of love, and a feeling of loneliness that people don't care, right? So, and she goes on to say that that the poverty that comes from that, or the hunger that comes from that, is even more vital to a human being's growth and development than feeding them a piece of bread. So if we could begin to shift our consciousness and know that the greatest investment is not just in stocks and bonds, but the greatest investment is in our youth, in our future, that I think we will make some gains. And to me, it's not a black issue. It's not a white issue, because if we look at African-American children today, yes, you know, we may lead in homicide and the killing of ourselves, but there is a heroin epidemic that's sweeping America, where young white children are constantly committing suicide. So black children and white children are not of the same race, but they seem to be racing to the casket, you know, if you will. So there is something going on in this country where the children in general don't want to be here. What are we going to do about it? And that's all of our children. They don't want to be here. This world is broken. And I think it comes back to the feeling of them not feeling like they are loved and have a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, that's a pretty big task to take on. That's difficult. And it's hard. How do you create? Because I know that this story has stayed with me for a long time. Your godson was killed, 28th in Burleigh. He was 16 years old. And his mother and his father did not attend his funeral. That story has stayed with me.
No love.
So where does love come from?
No love. Well, you know, it's you know, we are the surrogates. You know, we're the surrogate parents. You know, all of us, humanity, mankind. You know, I come from the African-American culture. So our culture has always had a history of the extended family. If the mother and father's, somebody's not there, then the grandmother steps in, the auntie steps in, somebody. And that's the village concept, that, you know, this child is not just belong to their biological parents, but they belong to all of us. And that is the type of mentality or cultural shift or mental shift that we have to make in this country. I was just blessed to be a part of the young man's life. And yes, his parent wasn't there, but there were many of us who stepped in and tried to do the best we could to show him something different. Unfortunately, you know, some of us will be, you know, our lives will be one that individuals can model themselves after. and other people's lives will be lessons of what you don't do or how you should not live. And still, you know, everywhere I go, I try to take Preston's T-shirt and remind young people of the inevitability of living a certain type of lifestyle, that they are not throwaway children. I don't know if he ever got that he had purpose in life. But there are no throwaway children. I believe that we are all children of God and we all have a great purpose. And as many young people that we can reach with that idea as possible, it'd be not only beneficial for their lives, but for the lives of mankind. Because what are we robbed of when we lose a child? We don't know what they could have been. Mm-hmm. We don't know what they could have given and what they could have contributed to mankind.
All right, so let's look at the instruments of the killing. It's interesting you talk about the opioid crisis, which is absolutely right. I mean, it's devastating so many towns. I saw this piece on CBS News last night where the aunt is taking care of four children and then has foster children staying right with her, who's, you know, never seen the father, just can't get off the drugs, and so they're lost. They're just lost. And the victims of violence, you know, don't have moms and dads around them.
Same thing.
It is the same thing. Mm. So what in the world are we supposed to do about these things that allow people to kill people? Drugs kill people. Guns kill people. I mean, this violence that's so horrible. What do we do about those instruments?
Right. I just, you know, I keep going back to the idea that we have to have a mental shift, because right now everything is about it's about money, you know. It's about capitalism. It's about accumulation. Mm-hmm. You know, how much can we accumulate?
Right.
And is the one thing that scares me about this presidency is because in many instances, folks will say that our current president personifies accumulation, personifies the gathering of wealth by any means. And it's the exact opposite moral values that we try to teach our children. Like, it's nothing wrong with success. It's nothing wrong with ambition. It's nothing wrong with being on this earth and trying to maximize the fullest potential of your life. Nothing wrong with that. But what type of human being does it turn you into?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make you the type of human being where you look down on others in a condescending way? Or does it, the more you have, does it infuse into your being the idea of the greater responsibility you have to share and to uplift other human beings? So I really think that it's not to simplify it, but we have to go back to the basics. You know, people over power. And if we cannot achieve that, we will continue to see, because the weapons of destruction, you know, a lot of times it's all about, you know, you have these young people and they're in environments with limited resources and limited love and guidance. So they're surviving. It becomes the Darwin thing. It becomes survival of the fittest. Right. So I have to eat. And if you have something, then I'm going to take it because nobody else is going to feed me. Right. So America has been known to be the most technologically advanced society in the world. Now we have to step up our game in terms of being the most moral and the spiritual champion of just human rights and how we're going to deal and relate to one another.
Hmm.
And that comes from the top down. Because if young people see it reflected, by analyzing society, that it's all about wealth and it's all about power, it's all about the car that you have or the clothes or how many women, where are they getting the values from? They're getting it from radio. They're getting it from television. And if that's the overpowering theme that they are constantly fed, then that's the mantra that they dance to and that they go for.
Yeah.
So
you essentially have to be a walking, talking alternative values kind of guy everywhere you go, right? You could live like you, and life would be better.
Lord. Lord, my voice is not loud enough, you know?
Yeah. Well, you need more voices like yours, I guess.
Yeah. I say oftentimes I go in the classroom and I do a hour workshop with some young people, and a 3-minute rap song is all out the window. My message, what I've just said. But you know, I do understand too. The great Les Brown tells this story about, they say, the Chinese bamboo tree, and they say that the Chinese bamboo tree, it takes about 5 years for it to grow. So you plant the seed in the ground and you water it. 5 years is about 2,000 days. So what have you done 2,000 days without seeing any growth and development? None of us, really. Everybody would kind of back away from that. But you keep on watering it for 2,000 days, and somewhere 2,000 days, and somewhere along the 2,000th day, this seed that hasn't grown for 5 years grows 90 feet in 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. Right? So how long did it take it to grow? 5 weeks or 5,000 days? I mean, 2,000 days. Of course, it took 5 years. And that's the kind of mentality that we have to have with our children, that we have to keep planting seeds. We have to keep watering those seeds. We have to keep praying and hoping for the best. And then one day maybe we'll look up and we'll see them become the human beings that God created them to be.
And I'll bet you've seen your fair share of that the horrors. You've seen that happen too.
Yeah, I've seen that the most joyful thing about my job is I say I get paid in two ways. You know, I get paid by a check, and of course I could take care of my family and move and operate in the way in the world the way in which I need to. But I get paid when I'm walking down the street sometimes and a young person comes up, and I've been doing this for years now. I might not even remember their name, but they remember me. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, thank you. Thank you, because I'm in college now and I'm doing something important with my life and going through the I Will Not Die Young campaign to flood the hood with dreams, allowed me to see the world in a different way. And that's all the payment that I need.
You don't need more than that.
Yes,
who needs mansions and millions? No, seriously, who needs it other than to give away?
Yeah.
That wouldn't be bad.
You can't take it with you.
Yeah, you're right. Mahbub Dyer is our guest for a few more minutes here. And we have time to, I don't know if we do or not. I'll give you the phone number. One call. We could do one call. That's all. 800-486-8655 is the number. He is the founder of the I Will Not Die Young campaign. He's done incredible work with millions of at-risk young people. And we'll have final words from him in a moment here on the Ideas Network. After hearing you, there will be people who may want to hear you more or may want to help you. Do you have some place to go?
Yes.
All right. What is it?
Well, they can. I have a couple different websites where they can try to reach out to me at. One is IWillNotDieYoungCampaign.com.
Okay.
That's IWillNotDieYoungCampaign.com and MuhibDyerSpeaks.com. That's MUHIBBDYERSpeaks.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really wanted to meet you again. And Scotty found you. Scotty will be with us on my last day. And we wanted to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
And so thank you for all you're doing.
I appreciate you. And I appreciate this platform and what it's meant to so many people. And it's an inspiration, you know?
We
all have an opportunity to, we have one life, and it's something when you find what you love.
Absolutely. I'm glad you found it. I found it too, actually. Thanks very much to Mahbub Dyer for being with us. Thanks to Colleen Leahy and Gretchen Brown for producing this program and for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow. We have a very eclectic show tomorrow. We're talking about therapy dogs and with a therapy dog and his owner tomorrow. It's the work I'm going to be starting next week, actually, when my puppy arrives. I have to train him. We're also speaking to Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker, to Bud Selig, and to David Axelrod. I've wanted to interview David Axelrod, who has a wonderful heart and really good political instincts, too. So he has agreed to join us. You tell people, hey, I'm retiring, and everybody says, okay, I should have said it years ago. And they said, oh, no, not really. Okay. So until tomorrow.